1996 Sense Sense Symposium presents Session 267, What Do I Believe? Mormon Creeds from Various Perspectives. The panel consists of Farrell Lines, Albert Eugene Peck, Nola Wallace, and Dennis Nilsen.
Okay. Welcome to Session 267, What Do I Believe? Mormon Creeds from Various Perspectives. First of all, why in the world are Mormons writing creeds? You know, we say we don't like creeds, and Joseph Smith spoke against creeds. But in the Christian tradition, there's a long, long tradition of writing creeds as a spiritual discipline. And people from St. Francis to Augustine to Aquinas all would write creeds that would express the core of their beliefs, the things that animated and governed their life. So why Mormons are against doctrinal creeds created by committees, I think a personal journey to try to sort out your own spiritual feelings. The creed is a very helpful format, and we're trying to make it a regular feature of the Sunstone Symposium. Actually, the idea for this was Peggy Fletcher's 15 years ago or so, when she came up with the idea for what is now called the Pillars of My Faith session. Peggy, having been a theology student at Berkeley, wanted people to distill the intellectual ideas that held up their faith. And her original idea was that everyone would get up and say, here are the four pillars that hold up my faith. 1, 2, 3, 4. That never happened. Pillars of my faith are just not such an abstract theoretical endeavor. When we ask someone to speak on the pillars of my faith, which R. Dean Watts will be doing tonight, most people give a spiritual journey. Mormons can't talk about their faith without talking about their personal story, which is probably true for most people of faith. And for the longest time, it was so frustrating for Peggy. And then, several years ago, we invited her to do pillars of my faith. And she got up and gave one of the longest stories, the history of Pillars of My Faith. And so we've said, but there's still value in trying to focus on concepts and ideas. So we've created this session where we invite people to write a creed. I'll read mine last, but it was a very troubling experience for me. Some creeds are like mottos, where here are the things that the aphorisms that I use to govern my life, you know, be kind to your neighbors, you know, don't kick dogs or whatever. I started writing my creed that way, and I had a hard time coming up with it. I think my faith is in a transition period, and so it's hard for me to put down in concreteness on paper, yes, this is me. And then, are these creeds descriptive? Am I writing something that says, these are the ideas that really govern my life, that are descriptive? I'm describing what really animates my life? Or am I being prescriptive? Am I writing ideas that I'm aiming for, that I'm shooting for? Because as I'm starting to write these things, I'm sitting there, everyone's going to know I'm a hypocrite because I don't really live these things, you know? And so which is it? Is it descriptive? Is it this? Joseph Smith, of course, wrote a creed even though he spoke against creeds, which were the Articles of Faith. Most of them start out, we believe. So I went to my creed and said, well, maybe I just should put I believe and then fill in the blanks. That's a very different thing from writing other statements like I can't get it. Anyhow, that creates a very different creed than if you chose a different model. I'm only sort of giving this outline, which I've discovered in my own writing, so that you can sort of analyze what you believe and think of the different approaches to writing creeds while the people are sharing theirs today. For a while, I settled on the things probably that really animate my life are the issues that I feel guilty about. You know, so then instead of I believe ... it's I feel guilty when, you know, I buy expensive clothing. You know, that means, oh, you know, luxuries versus giving to the poor. That's an issue that animates me. And maybe looking at your guilty areas is a way of discovering what truly is the creed that governs your life. Oh, having said this brief introduction, we've invited three people in addition to myself to share their creeds today. And We'll hear from them in the order in the program, except I'll sort of go last, hoping that everyone feels the time, and because mine are pretty short at the moment in my life. First, we'll hear from Farrell Lines, who's a very longtime friend of Sunstone, lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he's an attorney there. Next, we'll hear from Nola Wallace, another longtime friend, regular symposium attender, and author and presenter here. She lives in Southern California. Next, we'll hear from Dennis Nielsen, who is a physician here in Salt Lake. Dennis and I belong to a study group. You could almost call it a faith group. People get together and discuss about their faith, but the people who are on very interesting spiritual journeys, all of them. Dennis is also associated with the medical faculty at the university, or the psychology, the pediatrics at the university, you know, the medical faculty. So we'll hear from those three people and myself. And if there's time, then we'll open it up for a discussion afterwards. Okay.
As Elbert said, this has been very difficult. One of the things that has been most challenging to me for a long time, but stimulating as well. And I'm still not sure where I am in all of this, but I feel comfortable with presenting today and what I do have. As you would expect, as any good attorney would do, when I got the call from Elbert to do this, I immediately turned to my law dictionary to find out what in the heck a creed was, since we don't encourage them in the church and I hadn't been very associated. And I find that it's defined as a declaration or articles of one's religious faith or belief. Well, as I've pondered this assignment for a couple of months, I've realized that my creed is one that's ever-changing and static and really reflects my life's experiences. I was born and raised in a little remote town in southern New Mexico. It had been settled a generation before by people who had been run out of the Mormon colonies in Mexico by Pancho Villa and the Mexican Revolution. In the little town that was very remote and somewhat small, the church and the school and the community were all wrapped up in one. So in that environment, I grew up learning about the church, and I gained a testimony of the divinity of Christ and of the restoration of Joseph Smith. So as I look back, the cornerstone of my creed would be the Articles of Faith that I memorized in primary so many years ago and that have held me well for many, many years. Growing up in my small farm community, though, I think almost every family in the community subscribed to two magazines. One of them was the Improvement Era, which was the forerunner of the present-day Ensign, and the other was the American Farm Journal. Well, in the 50s, as I was growing up, we saw a rather interesting phenomenon. Elder Benson became Secretary of Agriculture, and although we didn't understand at the time what was happening, all of a sudden his John Birch friends, associates, really took over the Farm Bureau Association and the editorial pages of the Farm Journal. So every month I would be disturbed as that would come, and I started reading these editorials. It became so harsh and so divisive and so mean-spirited and so against minorities and the poor. And I really had a hard time with this. I had a number of discussions with people in the town saying this isn't even close to what Christ preached in the Beatitudes. But, of course, I would lose every conversation because at the end of the conversation it would always be, yes, but Elder Benson is apostle of the Lord. So the first change in my creed, I guess, was it became this: beware the philosophies of men that creep into our cultural beliefs if they contradict the teachings of Christ. I then left my small community and went on a mission to Western Canada, and there something happened to me that greatly altered my creed. For 6 months, while serving as a district leader in Vancouver, British Columbia, my companion and I lived in the basement of a wonderful LDS family that had immigrated from South Africa. The father was of Dutch descent, blonde and blue-eyed. They had joined the church in South Africa, but there was a policy in the church at that time that you had to be able to trace your genealogy out of Africa before you could receive the priesthood. And fortunately for this man, the church that his forefathers belonged to and all the records were kept, was burned in the Boer War, and so it was physically impossible for him to get his genealogy out of Africa. He had made trips to Holland and had done everything that he could. Mission presidents and others had pled his case, but after 8 years he still couldn't receive the priesthood. So they decided to emigrate closer to the center of Zion, so they came to Canada, and they at first went to Alberta, where Nathan Tanner was a state president. And President Tanner came to Salt Lake and pled with his cause, but to no avail. It was a policy that could not be rescinded or winked at, and the only way he could ever get the priesthood was to go back to South Africa and spend the rest of his life getting his genealogy out. During the time I was there, that 6 months, his oldest son was to turn 12, the oldest of his five sons. Just the week that I was leaving my mission, he confided in me that he was leaving the church and was going to join with some Mormon fundamentalists. He said, "I have enough faith, and so does my wife, that we could spend the rest of our lives and not have the priesthood." But he said, "I can't bear the pain of my five boys not being able to attend priesthood or go on missions or marry in the temple." And so that was the decision he made. Needless to say, I was devastated. And a new article was added to my creed that said, "Our general authorities are not infallible and sometimes lack or lose the spirit of revelation or inspiration as they pronounce policy or interpret doctrine." That experience also triggered an inner debate as to the extent and the frequency of God's communication or lack thereof with his church leadership after he guided the restoration. And after 30 years, I still haven't resolved that debate within myself. But another line has been added to the creed that would say, "I don't understand the extent of God's relationship and revelation to his church since the restoration." Among my heroes during my education years were President McKay, President Brown, Leonard Arrington, Dr. Pohl. But I also had some anti-heroes. I happened to be at BYU during the Ernest Wilkinson years, and I remember being shocked that at that time they would not allow women, blacks, or Democrats to speak to the university. I've been disturbed recently where I've heard general authorities who now have kind of expressed that same kind of anti-language, indicating that perhaps we shouldn't pursue intellectual thought, and even suggesting perhaps that our general authorities should do our thinking for us. This is my strength and my commitment to participate with groups that encourage thinking and discussion. So another article of creed reflects the scripture, "The glory of God is intelligence, and the intelligence we attain to in this life shall rise with us in the restoration, in the resurrection," as I paraphrase DNC 130. Several months ago, a lady in our ward got up to bear a testimony and said, "The world is evil, evil, evil." Well, that really caused me to ponder, and I thought a lot about that since that time. And I don't believe that. You know, I guess I'm an optimist by nature, but the people that I surround myself in our community, both in the church and out of the church, are really basically good people, hardworking, trying to do good. And I think the world is good, basically. I understand that there are problems in society and that there is a criminal element, but I think that if all of us really work together, that we can make a difference, although we're never going to make things perfect. So another one of my articles of creed would be, "Mankind is basically good, and the essence of the gospel of Christ is love and caring and compassion rather than fear and retreating," which goes against sometimes a lot of the messages that we hear in general bother me and make me sad, that we don't come from a more optimistic view as we approach the church. One of my great loves is watching the growth of the international church. It's exciting to witness the fulfilling of prophecy as we see literally dozens and dozens of stakes being formed in Latin America and in the far reaches of the world. Yet I'm saddened and frustrated as our leadership hasn't reflected the international diversity. Heck, the Utah church doesn't even understand what we need in New Mexico, much less what they need in South America. So I don't know how they can possibly meet their needs. So another article of my creed is this: the church can never meet its challenge to bless the lives of its members until the Quorum of the 12 Apostles reflect the diversity of our membership. During my 25 years of adult service, I've spent a lot of my time serving on high councils and bishoprics and quorum leaderships. and it's amazed me how much time we spend in wards trying to activate less active members. My wife and I recently moved back to a ward where I had served in a bishopric some 20 years ago, and I was astounded to attend ward council to see the time being spent still trying to light a fire in the same less active members where there had not been any spark whatsoever for 20 years. Then I contrast this with recent efforts of certain general authorities to cut off certain faithful, active intellectual members whose only sin is that they dare to write about historical events or recent policies or incidents that might be slightly embarrassing, or to begin dialogue on looking at certain policies or doctrines from a different perspective. I'm perplexed that certain general authorities seem to be so insecure about the church that they believe we cannot withstand honest scholarship and inquiry into our history and policies. So another creedal article emerged: we should celebrate the intellectual pursuit and dialogue in the church and should find joy in the diversity within our ranks. Finally, over the years, I've been involved in a lot of projects and activities, and I've come more and more to realize that there is nothing more important to me than my family. So my final article of creed is a paraphrasing from President McKay: the most important work I will accomplish in this life is to nurture and teach and be an example to my family. Now, if you ask me to do this again in 10 years or 5 years or maybe even another year, we might find that this is very different, but this is my creed as of today. Thanks.
By early teenage, I had come to realize that how we define God has less to do with the reality of the divine nature than with the level to which we had moved in our ability to conceptualize it. And so my creed became an evolving one. One thing I was absolutely certain about was that I could not fool God. My motives were totally transparent to him. I was responsible for whatever I did. My mother's withering, "But you knew better," discouraged buck passing, and God, of course, would know automatically. The Old Testament God was not only jealous, he lived by whatever rules he decided. Stopped the sun in his tracks if it was his whim. Early on, the Greeks tried to figure out how to deal with their numerous gods' arbitrary and irrational behavior, and one of the major dramatists confronted the problem head on. If the gods are not just, they are not gods. In the book of Job, Job confronted Jehovah, scoring a victory for himself in the argument over what constituted acceptably ethical divine behavior. The God of Christianity was monotheistic, yet comprised of Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, of which the Son was incarnate and was somehow both man and God. This I found impossible to visualize. And then there was the Mormon God, whose glory was intelligence, and whom I shall refer to as God, although there are clearly more than one, plus councils of them. A God the Mother, who showed up mainly in a hymn. A God the Father, to whom one prayed in the name of the Son. The Holy Ghost was bodiless, my inner monitor, my conscience, my guide to what things I must or must not do. As revealed to the prophet Joseph Smith, God was of the same species as men and women were. Further, each of our separate intelligences, each separate basic entity or personality, was not created but co-eternal with the divine. We, like the divine, were necessary beings and could not not exist. Traditional Christianity had concluded that God alone in the universe had created all things out of nothing. Since he had created all things were contingent upon him, and he could uncreate anything or anyone as well. This could and did create a major identity crisis for anyone contemplating the notion. Not so, said Joseph Smith. Not only did God operate by eternal natural laws, but he had developed through a long evolutionary process into being God, and from a state much like our own. We mortals had the potential of becoming gods, and we were commanded to learn and to teach each other toward that end. Doctrine and Covenant 88 study list is an exhaustive one. I find myself thrilled with the idea that courageous and imaginative scientists and creative artists are part of a creative prophetic calling. Carl Sagan, in his television series Cosmos, would declare, when pointing to the elemental identity between mankind and the rest of the universe, "We are star stuff. We are God stuff," I thought, interpreting the statement in terms of a convergence of knowledge and enlightenment, not of control nor dominion. I shall never know, of course, how Saul felt when he saw the light on the way to Damascus, but I do know that the light that illuminated my soul concerning the human potential has never dimmed. I was an only child born in rural Idaho, and my mother was widowed when I was 7 months old. Rural Idaho during the mid-1920s meant 7 miles to the closest small town where the closest telephone was. It meant no electricity, no indoor water supply, no indoor plumbing, dirt roads, dusty when dry, clay slippery when wet, impassable during snow. Water was from a hand-dug well, powered by a windmill, which gusty Idaho winds frequently drove beyond its braking control mechanisms, at which time the mill would spin wildly until the fragile wooden pump rods would break. Eventually, relatives and neighbors would rally around, but meantime, the water storage tank level would drop, and even the most stringent saving of water would not be enough to save even the vegetable garden. When we could, we got to church several miles away, and for a while we had a car, which my mother drove. But cars then were subject to several flat tires a trip over the rough roads. I vividly remember anxiously watching as a favorite teenage cousin used the patching kit to fix the inner tube, after which we jointly tested it for further leaks by submerging it in the horse's watering trough. Workers on the farm following my father's death were mainly relatives, but only part-time residents in the house. Most of the community were LDS, as were those who served on threshing crews, etc. But in the absence of a priesthood holder, help from God was called for by personal prayer, with priesthood blessings reserved for serious illness or emergency. Still, the tradition of healing was strong. My mother's father had been a friend of Brigham Young, had pulled a hand cart across the plains with his first wife, Marin Johanna, and had, with my grandmother, Hannah Margrethe, his plural wife, homesteaded his 160 acres in Idaho, where he had served as stake patriarch almost until his death in his 90th year. In my childhood, old-timers could tell me of his healing powers. I include the autobiographical material to indicate how, relatively isolated from other children, I became dependent on books. Books of scripture, school texts from several uncles' college studies in literature, history, philosophy, Victorian and Civil War novels, poetry, my father's books on animal husbandry, and praise be, Milton, Shakespeare, Wordsworth, Kipling, a rare and treasured book of fairy tales, and the prized early Mormon novel added upon. I was blessed to belong to a family which cherished education as an integral part of the Latter-day Saint gospel. I now suspect my childhood was atypical. Though my spiritual training was more scriptural and intellectual and church institutional, it was still strongly LDS, although without the underlying assumption that men were leaders and women were ancillary. I now see that it was predictable that I should be both unprepared and resentful when I realized that not to Greece, that cradle of critical thinking, nor to Jerusalem, cradle of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, would I be accepted as an equal. Not because of inherent inferiority of intellect nor of understanding, but because of my gender. Not to worry, though, were we still not dealing with concepts that lag behind reality? God is just. Ecclesiastical and political leaders may well have a conflict of interest in gender equality. The Latter-day Saint gospel was a great leveler. It was an inspiring reminder that all are alike unto Christ. The divine is no respecter of persons. All were on an ascending path of progression. All, leaders and members, were probationers. Prophets, even Joseph Smith, made mistakes, were reprimanded, repented, and got back on the continuum. There was no elite class who would not be allowed to lead the church astray. Revelation came to leaders and to individual members, and Brigham Young expressed concern that it should be taken for granted that he should always be right. Members, he felt, failed in their responsibility if they did not ask for and receive their own revelation, and if necessary, tell the leaders they were off course. Sustaining or not sustaining was to be done on the basis of private evaluation and not to curry favor with the leaders. These, of course, were the early idealistic days, with the revelation and the miraculous palpably present. Joseph Smith could criticize a council for harassing the elderly Pelletiah Brown for an error in doctrine. There weren't things you could get thrown out of the church for, he said. Mormonism wasn't like that, and it felt good not to be trammeled. On the 28th of April, 1842, he said to the newly founded Relief Society, "You will be responsible for your own sins. It is an honor to save yourselves. All are responsible to save themselves." This was the early ecstatic vision. In his landmark study of mass movements, The True Believer, Eric Hoffer describes this heady period in the early development of a religious institution as a time when the individual is out from under one system of collective discipline and has not yet succumbed to what he refers to as the, quote, stifling atmosphere of blind faith and disdain of self, end of quote. For Hoffer, institutions behave pretty much alike, whatever their purpose. The early period is a time of ferment, of innovation, of the testing of boundaries, of examining and evaluating which things are means and which are ends, etc. So Jesus could challenge Pharisees and Sadducees, the good conservative synagogue and temple attenders. Is the Sabbath for man, or is man for the Sabbath? Who is your neighbor? If you love only your friends and not your enemies, how are you better than the publicans? As Hoffer notes, as this dynamic early phase passes, a religious movement crystallizes in a hierarchy and a ritual. The institution frees a pattern of united action. The final phase is chiefly preoccupied with administering and perpetuating the power one. We must qualify here. Jacques Ellul, who's the subversion of Christianity, has helped clarify my thinking on the primitive church, reminds us that, quote, theologians never expressly desired or taught ideas or dogmas directly contrary to revelation. Even heretics were always seeking honestly to render an account of what they took to be revelation. In trying to understand events in my own religious institution, I have been studying the Nag Hammadi scroll findings of the late 1950s. Winners write history and divide the world of their concern between us, the Orthodox, and them, the heretics or apostates. Had it not been for the discovery of these scrolls, we might never have known about the variety of strains of religious thought in the early days of Christianity. Many of the records and early gospels were deliberately and systematically destroyed. Doubtless, these would have been also, except for some adherents who carefully hid them away against such pious plundering. In her conclusion to the Gnostic Gospels, Elaine Pagel says that if we go back to the earliest known sources of Christian traditional sayings of Jesus, we can see how both Gnostic and Orthodox forms of Christianity could emerge as variant interpretations of the teaching and significance of Christ. And one can see how conflict arose between these restless, inquiring people who marked out a path of self-discovery and the institutional framework that gave to the great majority of people religious sanction and ethical direction for their daily lives. It is to organized religion that we owe our social and religious rituals, our sacraments, our ways of celebrating birth, marriage, our funerals, much of our concepts of our important social and ethical responsibilities. It is to organized religion also that we owe our bloodiest atrocities. Power corrupts, religious power more than most. How quickly it asserts itself. In a letter attributed to Clement, Bishop of Rome, 90 to 100 AD, comes the first argument for dividing the clergy from the laity. To borrow a phrase from Animal Farm, some are already becoming more equal than others. Ignatius of Antioch, a generation later, says that since there is one God, there should only be one bishop, and he should be honored and obeyed as if he were God. It appears to have been Irenaeus who first declared infallibility around 180 AD. only within a religious organization which tacitly embraces the notion of infallibility is there any rationale to demand control in the form of unquestioning obedience. Obedience is clearly the authoritarian choice for the first law of heaven. Jesus said that the first and great commandment is to love God with all one's soul and all one's mind, and the second is likened to it, to love one's neighbor as oneself. Obedience is imitative, not innovative. It asks agreement with a conclusion already reached and which serves the agenda of the institution. It promises domestic peace, prestige, community, freedom from doctrinal error, from ecclesiastical censure. It can only give second-hand experience until another's testimony has been tested by one's own access to revelation. It is only hearsay. Unquestioning obedience frees you only from having to take charge of your own life. One of our sacred narratives, Moses 3, relates God's response to a plan put forth by Satan. He will guarantee all will be saved, not one will be lost. God rejects the plan. Why? Because, quote, Satan sought to destroy the agency of man. I caused him to be cast down. Without Christ's power to remit sin, neither Satan nor the ecclesiastical leader can deliver on the promise of total security or, worst case, amnesty. Mormonism included the conservative restoration and the extraordinary revelation given to the restless, question-asking young prophet. The opposition in all things, which he insisted must needs be, was inherent. In this consolidation stage of our institutional development, there appears to be zero tolerance for any form of opposition. Where is the forward thrust? Has the idea of progression become simply a naive and embarrassing notion, a historic aberration, or does this simply return us to the subject of agency versus obedience? According to a very old sacred narrative, Adam and Eve acted boldly in disobeying God and transgressing, thus inaugurating human history. They were created in the divine image and took autonomous action. I'm not sure they were punished. Are not struggle and pain as well as growth reality for all who choose agency and adulthood instead of remaining dependent children playing in a garden? Perhaps God respected their independence and initiative, as he had Job's. Agency is a very lonely and risk-laden venture. The more freedom we have, the less security. Yet we are launched on this perilous journey, and the Gospel of Luke includes Jesus saying that those who follow him would have to give up everything in order to do so. He comes to set families at variance against each other, not send peace on earth, but a sword. No one who does not take up his cross and follow him is worthy of him. This is not comforting. Who would choose this path? My speculation leads me toward believing that leaping ahead is always dangerous. But if the leap is not made and the risk assumed, no one gets beyond the status quo. Is this the path God took to become God? Is this the path we must dare to take in our own evolution? As mine is an evolving creed, it will be eternally incomplete. Yet Jesus promised that the Holy Spirit would be with us forever. I have found that contact with this powerful creative source has challenged me, instructed me, chided me, sustained me since I first became aware of its presence. Father, Mother, Redeemer, I do not know. These designations at least serve as metaphors when I try to communicate my particular private revelation to another. Praying in public is more difficult. Specific formal address almost feels like a stipulation that no other aspect of the divine need respond. But my need and my pain seem known when I can only find voice to cry, help me. When a lovely summer sunrise lights my Idaho Valley, or the beauty of a flower or a child's face or of clouds scudding across the sky before wind moves me, I can offer thanks and sense that I am heard. My present period of study and spiritual search was begun because I was haunted by the disbelief, disillusionment, and betrayal I had seen in the eyes of a young boy whose mother had recently been subject to the harsh winds that had scoured the Wasatch Front for the past 2 or 3 years. Who, I wondered, wore the millstone around his neck and had been drowned or worse because he had offended one of Christ's believing little ones. I had known that shepherds, being mortal, could be diverted from their primary role of protector and rescuer. But this was clearly a search and destroy mission, seemingly a cognitively dissonant enterprise for a shepherd. After intensive study, travail, pondering, and prayer, there came a kind of answer in a dream. Non-specific words, but the message was clear. Stop tormenting yourself. Your perspective is simply too limited. All is not correct. But we will keep sending, and in time it will be rightly understood. I both believe and am troubled by quite a bit as I follow my religious quest. I do not believe in human infallibility, and I am wary of unrighteous dominion. Now I ask myself this question. Has, does, or will a governing religious institution itself become the new Caesar to whom one must render total obedience as the price of community? Thank you.
Perhaps I've been a pediatrician too long, and I just want you to know, Albert, there will be time for discussion at the end. But as a pediatrician, I tend to like short people. As a poet, sometimes poet, I like short poems, and I've never quite achieved the brevity of Ogden, some of Ogden Nash's work, although I do have a one-line poem that I like very much. But this will be brief. But I do want to give you a little background about where I come from, because I'm a long way from where I started. I am a product of Mormon pioneers, both sides of my family. My mother is a Ludlow, part of the large Ludlow clan here in Utah, related to the BYU Emeritus Professor of Religion. My father is the great-grandson of Scandinavian converts and handcart pioneers. My parents have a strong and abiding faith in the Mormon Church. My grandfather was my first bishop and hero until he died of cancer when I was 11. As a young priesthood holder, I acquired an array of awards for church attendance. I was a youth leader and went on a mission to Peru and Bolivia. A year after my mission, I married the girl who waited for me, and we were married in the Salt Lake Temple by then Apostle Spencer W. Kimball. For years, I took my children to church every week, held a number of local church positions, and worked hard to be a believing Mormon. In spite of all this expending of energy, trying to be a standard Mormon, I am not. In fact, I might be what Robert Kirby has referred to as a no-mo-mo. I tell you this so that you will keep in mind the source of the creed that follows. It is personal. I make no claim of divine inspiration or authorship. I have absolutely no reason to suppose that anyone in this room will learn anything from it or that it will work for them. And I don't even know how long it will work for me. This is the second time I've done this, and I lost the first one, and this is completely different than I did the one I did the first time. So, like my life in general, it is a work in progress, and hopefully it's progress and not just change. I'd like to start with the first chapter of the Tao Te Ching, written by Lao Tzu over 3,000 years ago. The way that can be told is not the eternal way. The name that can be named is not the eternal name. The unnameable is the eternally real. Naming is the origin of all particular things. Free from desire, you realize the mystery. Caught in desire, you see only the manifestations. Yet mystery and manifestations arise from the same source. This source is called darkness. Darkness within darkness, the gateway to all mystery. Number one, I admit that I do not and probably never will understand the nature of the eternal. In fact, such understanding is really not of very great interest to me at this point in my life. I am content to live with unanswered questions. Howard Thurman has said that rather looking for the answers in life, we should live the questions. And I believe that in such living, we find the gateway to all of the really important questions and the mysteries of life. 2, I must live the best life I can without regard to reward or punishment in another world. It seems to me that attaching God's reward or punishment to my actions cheapens whatever good I do and invariably magnifies the stupidity of my mistakes. I want to be trusted to do the right thing for the right reason. I want to grow up. 3, I believe that the first principles of a good life are love and kindness. I suspect a lifetime is not long enough to learn perfect love and kindness, but pursuing these two ideals increases compassion, integrity, and wisdom, and engenders continual growth. There is nothing more powerful we can do to make a positive and lasting difference in the world than to love and be kind to all of our brother and sister humans. 4, I believe that life is the greatest miracle and that within it exist many smaller miracles. James Michener said that an age is called dark not because the light fails to shine, but because people refuse to see it. The age of miracles is not past. We simply refuse to see those that surround us every day. As a pediatrician at the university, I spend a good deal of time with young children. 5, everyone has something important to teach me. All I have to do is pay attention. That is the secret. Simple, but very, very difficult to do consistently. Pay attention. 6, I don't own much in this world. The things I pay for with the money I am paid for doing what I love, those things quickly break, wear out, go out of fashion, or disappear into my children's rooms. I don't own success. It is a slippery substance that arrives at its own whimsy and leaves quietly when it tires of my company. I don't own health. It has faded at some very inconvenient times. Someday someone else will live in the place that I call home. Someday I will lose my wife, or she will lose me. I don't own much in this world. 7, joy is terrific, but suffering, while paying attention, is my best teacher. It's not that I seek out the suffering, but in retrospect, even though the joy really feels good, it's never really taught me very much, and it's really been the hard things that I've had to deal with in my life that have turned out to be the most valuable experiences. 8, people who believe in the apocalyptic vision of the future have the perfect excuse to overpopulate our world, destroy the environment, and extinguish species, including our own. They expect that God will correct all of our mistakes on the last day, at the very last moment, with a glorious transformation of our sickly planet. I prefer to take responsibility for my own actions and believe that we should all do the same. The outcome is less predictable, but it might be better. 9, and this is the last one. I couldn't come up with 13. You know, I really tried, but I couldn't. Okay, 9. From time to time, I experience what I half jestingly refer to as my state of grace. I don't know exactly where it comes from or why it happens. It lasts for minutes or perhaps a few hours. I can't make it happen, but I must be open to it. Its visits started some years ago after I decided to take time for myself each day, to give more of myself to friends and family, to slow down, to give up self-centered ambition. When I'm in my state of grace, I am vitally and vibrantly connected with life. I feel ever so grateful for every breath. I see the extraordinary in the ordinary. The color of everything is brighter. I seem to understand more clearly. I am at peace with the world and with myself. I recommend it highly to all of you, whatever you might wish to name it. It might be an illusion, but then again, it might be heaven. Now, as I said, I only have 9 points in my personal creed this week, and I invite any of you to feel free to borrow them if they sound appealing. Try them on for size, or don't. Thank you.
Those of you who were there last night heard that I recently read almost everything Lowell Bunyan has written in the last couple of months. I've read everything he's written. And it's been fairly difficult for me to separate my creed from Lowell's creed at the moment. And that's been part of the problem. Do I really believe that, or is it just Lowell Bunyan reverberating in me at the moment? Which is a good thing. But one of the things he spoke about, which has really struck me recently, is the need to be creative. That if we believe we are created in the image of God, then we should be like the Creator. A major part of this life is being creative, and a major part of spirituality is being creative. That really resonates with me because I think what I do in my life uses a lot of creativity. You know, the shuffling, well, actually, my creativity comes in facilitating everyone, like in the symposium, you know. But it's a creative task to get everyone together and try to get them to be happy and all this sort of stuff and try to make it look, package it so people will come and stuff. But I really like doing that. And Lowell would also talk about how it is important when he would talk about youth. He says, if you want to keep your youth coming to church, they need to come where they feel that they can contribute and be and have a meaning and purpose. And you have that when you are creating. And this caused me to think on the second point, not only being creative to oneself, but making space for everyone else you encounter to be creative, rather than just merely reflecting your own creativity, which doesn't allow growth or spirituality in other people. I'm not sure how well I do that myself, but that's become a very important part of my recent creed, is to be focused on allowing that to happen for other people. Another thing that Lowell would speak about was the principle of integrity, that one should live one's life whole rather than compartmentalized. Speak about that in terms of religion. You can't compartmentalize different beliefs because we have to live them all together. We don't live our life in segments. We live it in a unity. I don't think I live my life as a total integrated life, but as I have grown, as I have lived, at least issues of integrity, of honesty with myself, being honest and trying to be honest with what I feel, why am I doing something, it's become an important part. And that relates to what am I hearing from the Spirit? Is that what I want to hear, or is it true? And the issues of silence. That issue. If I had to distill, I won't say that. For me, spirituality is at this moment three things. It is first a personal, ongoing dialogue with the divine other. And I think I feel that. It's sort of what Dennis would call moments of grace. They're brief periods, sometimes they're longer, but I see my life as a dialogue with God. Sometimes it's in descent through behavior and consciously, sometimes it's not. I hear promptings, much of it is in response to God or to the canon that I receive, but that is a very much a spiritual activity. I also then see spirituality as being social. So much of Jesus' teachings, so much of the Beatitudes, the Sermon on the Mount, are interpersonal. Be kind, be loving, be forgiving, ask for forgiveness, don't judge, sacrifice for others, live your life out in service for others. That's an everyday sort of living which I think is spiritual. I think it can be lived best, not as an individual, but as a community, where you nurture and provide opportunities for all of those, for the lived life of those Christian virtues in a believing community. So spirituality is a personal interior dialogue and social journey experienced in community. And then the third spirituality is, as I mentioned before, creativity. When I started to list I believe dot 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 for my own faith, you know, you hit the first article of faith. I believe in God the Eternal Father and in His Son Jesus Christ and in the Holy Ghost. I'm going, well, can I really say I believe that? I mean, it's easy for me to say believe that if belief is just an intellectual assent. But if it is something more of my whole soul, is that really what I am, then integrity makes me say, I don't know if I believe that. So instead of saying I believe dot dot, I start out with, I do not know. I do not know what or who God is, ultimately. But I believe that our descriptions of the divine are of human creation. I think they are metaphors that we have created through time, through history, that I have received through my tradition. Nevertheless, I find that these Christian metaphors of God best approximate for me the divine because they most perfectly give me access to the mystical. They challenge me to transform myself and my relations. And when I act day by day that Jesus lives and He is my Savior, that is transformative to me. Ultimately, I don't know if Jesus really is those things or if it just is a metaphor that allows me to operate in that spiritual world. But it does allow me to operate that in that spiritual world. And when I try to operate in using other metaphors, Western liberalism or humanism, humanistic, do love your brothers, they don't transform me and access me to a spiritual world which I know to be true, the way the Christian description of God and the divine are. So that's where I am on that part of my creed. Maybe for some people that's not important, but throughout my day I dance back and forth between do I believe that? No, but it works. I'm working with it. And other times I don't do that, but it's a very essential part of who I am. Finally, the other point I want to make is that I guess it comes from the social aspect, but I am haunted with the privilege that I have in my life, being aware by the privilege other people don't have. Lowell Bunyan was very much haunted by that, but it was Hugh Nibley who first laid the guilt trip on me. And the way that is articulated in a day-by-day living is to use the Doctrine and Covenants phrase, you know, that we need to, from the surplus of our living, we need to consecrate that surplus to help set up other people in self-sustaining stewardships. You know, whatever we need to give to the poor to help them. And I have concluded that everyone lives just up to their standard of living. You know, there's a quote I read, which a paraphrase is, even the most bleeding heart liberal lives in the largest house they can afford. Which is not creating a surplus. There is no surplus unless you act by self-denial and sacrifice. Creating a surplus to help the poor means consciously, intentionally lowering your standard of living. There's no other way to have a surplus unless you win the publisher's clearinghouse sweepstake. That is an element that haunts me. I try to live that. And the way I try to live that is by an Albert Schweitzer little method that he wrote about, which we printed recently in Sunstone, where he said every time you indulge yourself in a luxury, whether it's a nice dinner, whether it's a piece of clothing or what, you should give an equal amount of that amount of money to help the poor, to help clothe those who have nothing or feed those who don't have any food. And I try to do that I do fairly well on small things. If I buy a compact disc, I try to consecrate the same amount of money to helping the poor. But if I'm taking a trip for vacation, it's hard to match the airfare to the poor. But that is an element of my creed that I don't think I live it very well, but it haunts me daily about my life. So those are some of the key aspects that define my religious spiritual life on a day-by-day basis. I have 5 minutes, so if anyone wants to make comments, we can take some time. Yes. Maybe we should... there's no questions, so there's no one here to really respond, so maybe we should make the comments in the microphone.
A couple of years ago, one of these sessions struck me with a need to develop my own articles of faith, too, and I struggled with it. Finally, I came up with something that might be of help to some of the rest of you. Instead of saying, I believe, or I know all the way through, I had to prioritize those things that affect my life. So I came up with categories of I know, and there were, surprisingly, a few things that I felt like I could say that I know. Quite a few things that I could believe. That's the faith kinds of things. It was also a category of I accept. Those are things that you say it works. I've discovered this. I take it as a truism. And a lot of things went there. And then it was a great big last category of I hope. And surprisingly, most of the salvation kinds of things fell in that last category.
Anyone else have a comment or something that they'd like to say? Okay, well, we'll do this next year and keep plugging away at it. Thank you.